Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Anthony Ross. I am your host of Strength to Be Human, and this is going to be another episode of Classic Spotlight, episode number 36. At this time, we are looking into the writings and the life of Aldous Huxley. Now, he is very well known for Brave New World, but there are also many other novels and many other thoughts and concepts behind the man, so let's talk a bit about him, okay? Now, Aldous Huxley was a man born in the 1900s, so he's not someone from the same century as Edgar Allan Poe. He was able to experience a lot of the technology that we started to put together in the early 19th century. So it's interesting that he had a lot of thoughts on that. Aldous Huxley was not a man of poverty like many writers of his time. He was actually born into a well-to-do family. They wasn't super rich, but they were definitely in the upper middle class of England. He was the grandson of Thomas Huxley, who was a very famous zoologist. Did a lot of work on apes and orangutans. And of course, being someone from that era, he was able to go to some of the best schools. Interesting about Aldous Huxley is, unlike his grandfather, or even a lot of people during his, I guess you could say, his financial peers, or his class peers, he was not the dry academic type. He seemed to have interest beyond all of that. And I'm sure there's a connection. I mean, it's obviously not 100%, but I find more and more that when people have certain events in their life or certain maybe ailments in their life, it tends to make them a little bit more sensitive to others out in the world or even to their own selves. And Aldous Huxley was a perfect example of this because he suffered through many bouts of vision issues and even bouts of blindness. All through his entire life, he had a lot of problems with that. Maybe it caused him to be a little bit more seeking in depth the vision of afterworlds or the vision of inside of himself or just things outside of science. He spoke a lot about science, but he also was looking at things beyond science. He wasn't exactly a religious fellow, but he kept his mind open enough to wonder what was going on, if there was anything going on in the afterworld and how people felt they can have access to that. So he began in the 1920s as a poet. He wrote a couple of books about poetry. They were well received, but that really wasn't his real calling. His real calling was novels. He wrote over 50 novels in his lifetime, as well as 8 poetry collections. We'll talk about this later on, but he even did some work in Hollywood of some screenplays. I guess it's a way to make some money, trade off his name a little bit because he started becoming famous. He had a number of interesting novels before we get to some of the more famous ones. One, The Devil's Aludin, that was very interesting about these nuns that were accused of being demon-possessed in a convent. That's supposed to be a true story, actually. So he wrote about that. Another interesting book he wrote about was Island. It was about someone creating a more positive utopia on an island. Utopian was a big theme in a number of his writings. And, of course, he was most famous for Brave New World and its nonfiction follow-up, Brave New World Revisited. And let's talk a little bit about that because it's a central part of his fame, of his notoriety, of his awards, of just about everything in his life. Brave New World came out in 1938, and it's very interesting that here is a book that concentrated on some of the negative uses of technology, but how a government could use them to enslave people, but in a positive way, that they didn't even know that they had lost their freedom. Unlike George Orwell, who dealt with the negative consequences of technology in terms of depriving you of things and keeping you off balance by distracting you, well, Huxley figured out, and he's probably closer to the future than anyone else has come to. Now in the 2019, we can see some of those things. He felt the same thing, that a government could only take your freedoms through distraction. So he came up with a more positive distraction. So the government would let you have what they call free love, meaning that you can have all kinds of sex. They give you a pill called Soma, and that'll keep you happy, not so concentrated on the details of how the world was working. They figured out a way that people can be born in chambers instead of childbirth, because that was like, you know, caveman stuff. You should just simply have your child in a, you know, in an artificial womb and then, you know, go pick it up later. But inside these things, they were born in various classes. So, you know, you had a group that would be the worker people, and you had another group that would be the administrators, and another group that would be the managers, and another group that would be the scientists. And so everybody was born in a certain group, and you wasn't able to get out of it. So that's another loss of your freedom, because you're already born in many ways a slave. So between those distractions of drugs, Soma, free sex, you know, free love, being born in a certain caste or class group, you didn't know what was going on any longer. The government had, and the society had, total control of your life. And that was the Brave New World that he was talking about. And he was afraid that those things would happen in the near future. And in some aspects, that's true, but not all of it. We're not in the artificial womb stage yet. We're not so in depth on our society that we can go that far. It would right now, it wouldn't be possible. You'd have to have, you know, millions of people gone in order to be able to start over again and do something like that. Otherwise, it's just too many people in the way for something like that. But that society was able to do it, because I think they started off from some sort of a Holocaust, and they were separate from other people that lived outside of their city, that lived the normal way, had natural childbirth, and didn't live the same way. They considered those people primitive. But, you know, who is the primitive? Yeah, a person in, you know, bear skins and having natural childbirth, but they have the freedom of the land and what they can do and what they can eat, or somebody lives in a controlled, mega controlled environment where, you know, none of the decisions that they're making really are their own, other than having sex and dropping a pill. Unfortunately, in 2019, we got a bunch of knuckleheads that probably think that's a wonderful way of life, but that just shows you how dangerous that society had become. It's just zero freedom. Just because you're having sex with somebody doesn't mean you have freedom. You're just a robot reproducing. And not even reproducing, because they took that from you. You got to have babies in an artificial chamber. Amazing. Now, Huxley became very famous for these books. They were very influential. He came out a few years later with Brave New World Revisited. It's a small book that was nonfiction, essays, articles. And he just talked about some of the things in that era of technology that could be used possibly towards what he was talking about in Brave New World. Some of his ideas make some sense. Others, you know, they don't really have much scientific validity. Like he believed in hypnopedia, which was like you learning educational lessons or things that people want you to know through sleeping and just listening to a speaker. Well, we know that really doesn't actually work in any kind of efficient way. So that didn't really work. But he did talk about commercials and radio shows and even television having an effect on you and giving you a distracting. That's true. It does distract people. But so does their complex daily lives, too. So, you know, only can go so far with that. It was an interesting read. Brave New World Revisited. I certainly encourage it, but it's in many ways outdated because it's nonfiction. And he wasn't able to really bring a point, the same points that he was able to do in the novel. Now, interesting enough, is Huxley became real famous for many of these things. He was able to talk around the countries in the 60s. They put together a book. One of my favorite is called The Human Condition, and it's pretty much all his speeches of various colleges he did throughout the United States. And they're really wonderful. They're very enlightening as nonfiction things. Still can be read to this day about human language and how that began and our communication through art. And it's just really fascinating subjects. The man really had some brilliant ideas and some real insight. I know he spent a great deal reading because of his eyesight. He couldn't see a whole lot beyond his face, but he was able to read. And he's a real studying guy, real student of many things. And you can see it in his writings. He oftentimes spoke really with very little notes. I mean, they footnote the book because he just can quote stuff without reviewing anything. I mean, because he just knew it. So that's really really fascinating in itself. And Aldous Huxley, he went to Hollywood for a while there. They should have do some screenplays. I know he helped with the screenplay of Pride and Prejudice. I'm also told that he helped in some capacity with The Wizard of Oz. So he had some work out there. And I know he made some money from it, but I think he just grew tired of that. He only did a few projects out there. He wound up settling in the United States, and that's where he wound up living and ultimately dying. Now, some very interesting things about Aldous Huxley is, and these are things that are not really well known. He was nominated 7 times for the Nobel Prize for Literature. Incredible that he never won, because I always felt that he was one of the modern writers that deserved it. But, never won, 7 times nominated. Aldous Huxley also was not only an unconventional thinker, but he even lived in an unconventional manner. He wound up marrying a woman that seemed to have no problem with almost like an open marriage. He was famous for having a menage a trois, which is like 2 girls and a guy. And there's a lot of rumors that his wife might have been gay anyway. So he had some interesting personal life over there. He didn't make it into a scandal that was in the papers or anything like that, but people were well known about some of his unusual exploits. Who knows why? Because he never really wrote anything about sex or anything that unusual in that way. But that's pretty much how he lived a lot of his life, in an unusual marital arrangement, as you might want to call that. Now, Aldous Huxley is also pretty famous for, and I'm going to put this into the right context, because this is not a man, ironically, that was pro-drugs. He really didn't think those were things were good for society. And he felt that drug users on a regular basis can harm themselves, distract themselves, and become lesser participants in democracies, because they can be dangerous elements. They can be used to ultimately control you. Imagine if a government can give out drugs on a regular basis. You know, they can influence people to vote certain ways, or they can engineer people to die. Oh yeah, he overdid, but maybe there was somebody that didn't like their opinions or something. So there's a lot of controlling evil factors with drugs that sometimes people don't realize that can be out there or could be used. So he wasn't a proponent of that, but he did want to find out why the American Indians saw so many things. They had so many different visions, and so he wanted to understand if it was just the sweat lodges or were they doing something else. So he wound up participating in both the early phases of LSD, and also he used some peyote, which they used to call magic mushrooms back then. It's a kind of a plant that had a hallucinogenic natural chemical in it. And he wrote down a lot of things that he saw, a lot of various visions and excuse me thoughts. Through all this, through journals, and then when he got off of that, he wound up composing 2 books. These are also 2 books that were very influential for him. One we'll call The Doors of Perception. That's where Jim Morrison had read, was influenced by that book, and he wound up calling his band The Doors, based on that book. And the other one's called Heaven and Hell. So both these books were about his experience under the influence of those drugs. Now, remember, he wasn't taking these things for recreational reasons. I know that probably sounds unusual that he was just taking them for educational or literary reasons. But for him, that's actually the truth, because he is not somebody that does that sort of thing on a regular basis. I don't know. He's into kinky sex, but didn't really care too much for drugs. this wasn't one of the drinking kind of people, other than the British generally type of stuff. So he really didn't have any serious vices in his life. Now, these books are still to this day revisited in terms of the things they had saw. He had understood that it's possible that there could be access to another dimension or possibly another spiritual plane, because the drugs will allow your mind to get there, to access that and check it out. And that's what he felt the American Indians were looking into. Was there a way to get to God or a deeper spiritual meaning of all this? We can only speculate. You know, maybe just because I'm more restricted as a person that's a Christian, believing that prayer is a good access to God. You don't actually need to take a drug to get anywhere with God. Others might believe otherwise. So I'll leave that to them, and that's fine. But he wanted to explore that because he wanted to see for himself. And that's an operative word here for Aldous Huxley. He wanted to see more than he could see. Because remember, he had all these physical issues with his eyes. So it's another interesting thing on why he wanted to do this, because he was able to use the full set of his eyes and further than he ever could before by under the influence of these drugs. So in a way, he was also a visual aid for them, unusually. But it worked, and I know he was very excited about that. Now, also, it was important for Aldous Huxley, because even though he was an agnostic, he wasn't an atheist, he wasn't sure about God. He wanted to see evidence, and this is another way of part of his spiritual quest to see, you know, what could be out there, what could be discovered. And, you know, he wrote two books, so he definitely discovered some things. He definitely thought that what the Indians were seeing and trying to do and connecting it to a religious practice of theirs had a lot of merit to it, that he saw the you know, the validity of it all, and ultimately the reality of other planes of existence out there, and how we can access them. So I always found Huxley fascinating, mainly because of just the surroundings of his birth and how he's grown up in a very staid, I wouldn't say stale, but very formal, you know, upper middle class background. You know, the grandson of some of the famous scientists, going to some of the best schools, and still, he wound up becoming a very influential writing on things that would not normally come out of the British, you know, thought frame. I mean, really, it's just how he really ventured out. And unlike others, like Orwell would be a perfect example of writing in terms of a political rebellion, Aldous Huxley really wasn't much into politics. I mean, he was against the war movement. He thought war was stupid and counterproductive to the planet. I mean, on an academic basis, he's correct. And unfortunately, as stupid as might war might be, you know, there's some valid reasons for it, and especially in, you know, your own national defense. But he was a pacifist, and he didn't believe in any of that. You know, of course, he also believed more that overpopulation could really harm the planet. So Aldous Huxley was a big sponsor of birth control for women and even for men back in his day. You know, they didn't have anything yet other than the condom, but he believed that one day a pill should be available for men as well. And he believed that having a more controlled population on the planet would allow us to have more resources. Ironically, that hasn't really come to pass, mainly because we were able to figure out, thankfully, through science, on how to grow plants more plentiful, how to figure out ways to conserve water or clean water or desalinate water, like Saudi Arabia and some of the Middle East countries do. Take it right from the ocean, put it in a plant, and it comes out fresh. So those are ways that we'll be able to continue to feed people, because we really have a controlled population. Now, I'm not saying that because we've done that, let's just give up the idea of population control. I still think it has some merit. It really does. It's just, how do you figure out how to really do that without, you know, becoming a fascist or a dictator yourself, or becoming like China, one child, one couple? You know, they might have felt it was necessary, but look how draconian they went, encouraging abortions and, you know, beating up people who had more than one kid or taking them away. That's a lot of horrible things that you don't want to be doing to control, you know, your population. I mean, obviously, if a male pill came out, that could be very helpful. You know, that men can take that. So this way they can help that they don't reproduce by accident or until they're ready. So that's a real possibility. But, you know, figure out a practical plan of it or hitting certain numbers, I'm not even sure if we're ready for that. We have to be a lot more mature, I think, as a civilization, because we seem to always want to just force things rather than just trying to convince people. I mean, who's to say we can't convince people by putting things out there? And maybe it's not 100% successful, but any kind of curbing of the population over a span of the whole planet could be still in the millions that you've reduced. And you did it in a healthy way, and you did it in a democratic way. You did it in a way that was involving free will rather than, you know, forcing people. But, you know, until we get to that day. But it's definitely a credible thing that Huxley was involved in. Huxley was really interested in the things that can harm society, because he realized that the more you harm society, the more you damage democracy. And if you start damaging, you know, the voting process and the aspects of free will and democratic institutions, you're going to go right over into either a Brave New World situation or worse. But you're going into some kind of dictatorship, because that's what happens. When you start eroding freedoms, well, then the other side will take over, because it means that people don't have faith in those things anymore. And that, of course, is a major sad thing. So that's why Huxley was so much involved in believing in education in different ways, and believing in population control, you know, in of course, a decent fashion. A big believer in that war was stupid, and we had to figure out ways to try to be more diplomatic. You know, a big believer in writing and in communication. And, of course, he was a big believer in doing our best to not be so distracted by things that were idiotic in the world. Huxley was always suspicious of corporations. I think most writers who had social reform ideas, or just writers of social reforms in general, were always suspicious of any kind of mechanical auspice or corporation. Dickens, not happy with the factories and how they enslaved lots of people, especially young children, polluted the air. I know Huxley was definitely not too happy with corporations, so he felt they can manipulate even governments, and oftentimes they produced products that were, you know, either damaging to ourselves or harmful to the environment, or maybe just they were just practice runs for having a more militaristic or commercialized type of government, that they were a good trial run for that. And some of that is true. I mean, multinational companies oftentimes are not really responsible to any one government. Kind of makes them harder to pin down on their responsibility, on their accountability, on their financial well-being, on their taxes, even sometimes on their products. So, yeah, that can be a problem. We don't have zillions of them controlling the planet, but, you know, there's enough to have some worry in that. So there's no doubt that he saw that. Now, some other interesting things about Aldous Huxley that I thought to bring to the attention of folks was, he was not just a writer. In many ways, Aldous Huxley felt that he was some kind of like social evangelist. I mean, he wanted to really improve the society. So in many ways, he was like one of the social writers that I wanted to talk about in my social writing series. And I probably will probably include a small snippet of some of the stuff he did, because unlike George Orwell, who wanted to be the same thing, Huxley actually went out and met the public. He actually went to colleges and lectured. He actually talked to people, you know, and gave numerous speeches. So he had an idea of having some kind of a change in society or in the world, and that maybe he can help affect that. So he was definitely involved in wanting to do that, and that seemed to be a major point in many of his books, that he thought that was an important thing to do, and that he had a say in that. It's probably why also he was nominated so many times, because oftentimes when you are a writer of a social realm, a lot of times you could be nominated, you know, once or twice or whatever for a Nobel Peace Prize, because it also includes beyond the literary. You went into the social world, went into the political world, you know, etc. And that's definitely why he got so many nominations, because even though he's author of many novels, 50 actually, only a handful of them really became big and well known. A lot of them, you know, did not. You know, and I seriously doubt that they would have given him a Nobel Peace Prize nomination over a book about, you know, taking drugs on a reservation and seeing visions. So, I mean, he definitely was more involved in the social aspects of life. One of his important books, Political Philosophy, was another one of those books of essays that about life, about being more accountable to ourselves and how that made us better citizens in a democracy, and how we became better neighbors to others. And maybe that way we would have less of a chance of war, because possibly we can head it off, you know, by willing to communicate more. And there's nothing wrong with those things. I don't really think he was too far off from a lot of the things that are necessary to still talk about today. I mean, abolition of war, wonderful goal. Can't really see how that can ever be possible on Earth. I mean, right now, with there's probably at least 20, 30 wars going on still to this day. Small, but nevertheless. And that's not really because something is wrong with the human condition that we have to have war. It has really more to do with the fact that until both sides are tired of doing so and want to come to something more reasonable and go on with their lives, it's gonna continue. Because basically, wars do not stop until both sides are convinced that it's not worth it to go on any longer. It's too expensive or too costly. People want to go back to having a normal life again. Kind of hard to have a marriage and a family when you're constantly at war. So until more people realize that, you're going to have that. Of course, and then you're going to have also parties in war that are defending themselves that don't really want to be in it, but they don't have a choice because the other side has engaged them. The other side feels that only through war can they get their point across, which could be that they have forcing a religion on them or forcing a political philosophy or just want to steal land or take resources, because those are really still just simply the basic reasons for that. And that's why money wars start, for those reasons. They don't really start because people are misunderstanding themselves. Yeah, let's kill 10,000 people because I didn't catch what you were thinking. No. Diplomats and diplomacy can still handle stuff like that. Wars are usually started because one side wants something from the other, or wants the other to do something that they're not doing. So it's often about forcing something or stealing something. That's really what it is. It's nothing more complicated than that. And that's why wars continue, because you still have forces and people that are willing to do that. And I think Aldous Huxley especially understood that. And he came from that generation where, you know, massive wars, especially, you know, World War I and World War II, you know, devastated Europe and many parts of the world. And millions upon millions died. Some of them even in genocides like the Holocaust, things unheard of before in the history of mankind. And he was part of that and witness to that sort of nonsense. So I'm not really surprised that, you know, he would use his vision, so to speak, you know, the inside vision, the intellectual vision, to put together books and to put together ideas and to put together notions and to be part of things that were necessary, he felt, to try to steer the world and the earth in another direction. So he definitely is to be commended for something like that, especially. I've always admired him. He's been a major influencer of my own life. I remember going to the library when I was a child, and I was always into reading books, but I never really listened to audio cassettes too much. But they started coming out more significantly in the late 70s and early 80s, and the library had one, Brave New World. You know, I knew from the book, but I'm like, wow, it'd be interesting to hear this. So I borrowed it and listened to it, and I really became fascinated with the auto cassette of it and British author. It was just so interesting. And I just never gave that up from there. So I remember, Years later, after joining the Air Force, I went over to London for my 21st birthday when I was living in Europe working for the Air Force. And so I got to a little bookstore, which was underneath Big Ben, and I was able to pick up the original copy of the collected speeches called The Human Condition from Aldous Huxley. It was a rare book in the sense that it wasn't even released in America there for a while, so it's still hard to get. You'd have to like order it on the internet or something. But it was incredibly fascinating. In many ways, it was even more influential than some of his other writings. Those college lectures were really something else. I wish I could have been there listening. But Alex Huxley was a man of his time, who's also a man of his class and generation. So ironically, he was still one of those kind of guys that he really would only hang around the people that came around from his lifestyle. He's not some kind of guy that'd hang and talk out with his fans or somebody that might have been interested in him that wasn't part of his, his upbringing or life. He was still kind of confined to that. That's just socially who he was, and that's fine. I mean, I don't know if I want to hang out with him and 10 minutes later, this guy's breaking into sex parties and stuff. That's okay. But most writers were like that. I think Charles Dickens is probably one of the few writers that became big and famous and wealthy, but still didn't mind hanging out with other people, different people from all walks of life, and didn't have any problem with that. Maybe because he worked in a factory when he was little, maybe because he never finished formal education. I don't know. Maybe that has a real element into it, but, he was much more of a people's person, and many writers simply were not. They're not really people that would have been so easy to let their head down or talk casually about anything or, even have other pastimes. I mean, it's so amazing to find out that so many writers didn't even have many hobbies. Writing and the pursuit of all these thoughts and ideas and stuff they do was it. I mean, Hugo is probably one of the few people that, even though his sketching wasn't a hobby, was serious to him, and he did 4,000 of them in his lifetime. He was able to go back to that whenever he was done with writing or taking a break from it. I don't think a lot of other writers couldn't. Most of them did not really have much of a pastime to go to. Sports or music or the opera or theater or whatever. It's amazing how a few of them had any real hobbies. I always find that interesting and fascinating. I don't know if you want to call them workaholics in the classic word that we use now, because in many ways, they were simply just passionate disciples of some of the things they wanted to get done. And they wanted to get done, while they had, healthy lives. Remember, unlike our century, where men can live to 75, 85, 50, 100 years ago, people were still dying in their 50s. And sometimes earlier than that. So, you think about it, by the time you finish college and you're around, your early 20s, what do you have maybe between that and getting married and having kids? You have maybe a good 20-something years left to write and do things. So you don't have a lot. I mean, Victor Hugo lived a very long life, but most writers did not. So they only had so much they could do. I mean, look at poor Edgar Allan Poe. He died when he was 40. He left a lot of work, but imagine all the work he still could have been doing. It's amazing. And he was definitely another one that did not have much of a hobby of anything. I don't even think Edgar Allan Poe had any hobbies. I swear, I think if he wasn't writing his own stuff, he was reviewing somebody else's or editing a magazine or doing, he's just always doing something literary. So he was definitely not a guy that was out there playing checkers or chess or collecting stamps or, going to operas. Don't even think he cared about any of that stuff. So I always found that really fascinating, how focused and how centered and how committed these writers were, and how it made a real impact lasting in their careers and in their writing. Some of the questions I had from people that talked to me over the last couple of weeks when I made some formal announcement I was going to be doing this classic spotlight with Alex Huxley was, one had asked if Alex Huxley believed that technology was ultimately dangerous and that we should go back to a more rural agricultural setting. And I think, and thank you for asking that question, by the way. I think they asked that because Brave New World, especially, one of the main characters was able to get out of the area, the city, and go into the, you know, to primitive lands where people had, you know, children, natural birth, and didn't live in such a techno, you know, environment, and didn't take drugs and didn't do any of that, and how that was more free. But I'm not really, maybe because I'm a city person, possibly, but I'm not really a big believer that just because you live on a farm or you live in a rural area, or you live in an area that you're not using too much technology, that somehow you're having more freedom. I don't really see that. If anything, people who live in a rural area or farm area, they're doing more work than most people do. You know, most farmer people I met, especially the younger people I met who later went into the Air Force, said a 12-hour shift in the Air Force still wasn't nothing compared to a regular day. You know, where people are out there doing 14, 16-hour shifts. I know my friend Mitch from Nebraska, I think his family had a big old cornfield. I mean, he was out there in the morning shooting rats with his rifle and making sure the, you know, the grain was safe from animals, and keeping the sheep from dying, and keeping the cows milked, and baling hay, and it's just one job after another. So by the time you're ready to settle to have dinner, and you had like an hour left before you just knocked out. I mean, you'd be exhausted all the time. So me, I don't know how much freedom that's supposed to be or how fun that's supposed to be. And I'm not making fun of any of it. It's noble life and certainly an important segment of our society. We need those things. We need those products. But and you really can't call them technology free, because if anything, farms is back to when they had the, you know, the gin press. I mean, they needed technology. Machines helped them to do more with plants and to do less hard work. So to this day, machines are a huge part of any farm. You're not going to see farms without them be able to go very long. So they're certainly not going to be technology free or machine free. That's just not really possible. So no, I don't think he was really advocating that. Cities are still important parts of our modern life, mainly because they keep us away from those elements so that we can have things that we can preserve for our own knowledge, like zoos and museums and institutes to study things and medical facilities and big important hospitals where they're doing all kinds of research. You're not exactly doing these things in the agricultural and the rural areas. You're going to be doing these things in the more sophisticated modern area where people are going to be attracted to come and to live because they're doing those sort of things. So those are all important. So I never felt that it was some big fight between the city and the rural areas or the farmers and the city guys, or that's all, you know, that's all rock and roll song nonsense. But in reality, they need each other. The cities need the agricultural people because that's where all the stuff comes from that can keeps the city going. And agricultural people need the cities because that's where they're selling this stuff to. You can't be a farmer and just sell yourself to your community. You'd be broke in about a day. It has to go to the thousands and millions of others that need that. So they need each other, and they're important for each other. So no, I don't really think that he was advocating that. He was advocating, though, a more technologically smart society that didn't go as far as trying to, you know, stop women from having babies and let them have them in factories and stuff. That's obviously stupid and inhuman. So definitely he was against that sort of stuff. And of course he was against any kind of technology that might be able to use to commit mass murder and you know, equipment or anything like that. He simply felt that we had less of that. Maybe we'd be willing to use less of it. But, you know, even though that was a noble thought, it's just like the same people who want to ban guns. It's simply not realistic, you know what I mean? Because you can't ban guns and believe that somehow you have now improved the human condition, that you've now banned the killer instinct. Somebody wants to kill you, they can still create a bomb with household items and blow you up. They can still go into your house and stab you to death. They can still use the axe and cut you to pieces. They can stab you in both your eyes with a pencil that's sharpened and then hit you in the throat a couple times until you're dead. You can't ban pencils. You're certainly not going to ban knives or axes, things that we need to use in our lives for important reasons. So banning guns is not going to solve anything. So it's one of those knee-jerk reactions from people that don't want to take the hard work of trying to figure out why violent acts happen. And most violent act happens because of mental illness. And we need to tackle that more in society. And once we did that more, you see a lot of these crazy crime sprees stop. They're not the same thing as terrorism because it has more to do with the cult and political and religious fanaticism and has nothing to do with the average mental ill person. In fact, most terrorists are not mentally ill at all. So those are just regular criminals doing things. They're not the mentally ill. So another question we had from someone was about Huxley's belief in women. The person had asked, was he anti-woman? Was he anti-sexual? Now, I think they were asking that mainly because how he took away the ability for women to have babies and put it into the sort of factories. And I say no, he wasn't that way. Actually, Huxley was one of the earlier writers to believe in women's rights and promoted those a great deal. So, no, he wasn't anti-woman. If you understand Brave New World, you understand that the reason why that was taken away from women is for two reasons. First of all, if you want to help control the society's future and you want to have these babies in these incubators and then give them a certain job assignment so they were born to do something, automatic slaves, well, you can't do that in women's wombs. You got to have to control that process in giant warehouse factories. So that's mainly the reason for that in the book. But also the reason, too, is you're giving up pills, you're encouraging free sex, you know, kind of hard to have a lot of free sex when women are pregnant all over the place. So to take that element out, also continue the sex thing that that government was producing and promoting. So that's another reason why the sex pregnancy was taken away from women. So it was just a book notion just to follow the crazy logic of that society on controlling people. Had nothing to do with women. And the last question was about the drugs. They were wondering about, was Huxley some kind of an early hippie? Actually, he wasn't. Huxley was pretty much the, other than intellectually, and maybe some of his curiosities, he was pretty much the man that you would expect him to be born. You know, a suit-wearing guy, a very formal fellow, had some humor, but still a pretty serious person. They have a lot of vision problems and everything, but you know, he hung around the wealthy people, the educated people. He knew them all. That's what his whole life was, and that's how he, lived and pretty much died. So no, he was not a hippie and didn't believe in any of that stuff. Remember, he was against. Actually, he was for casual sex. He was okay with that, but he was against casual and recreational drug use. He thought that was simply a bad thing for society. And he was okay with the casual sex because he wasn't a moralist and he believed that we kind of get carried away with that. And that curtails some people's freedom. So he thought that sex was okay. You know, drugs were not. Now, one of the last notes is some of the fascinating things of the last days of his life. Huxley went to Arizona. He thought the weather was better for his health. He was suffering from throat and esophageal and lung cancer. So he had some horrible things to deal with. There wasn't many treatable ways of doing things as they could do things now. And so he had a lot of painful and horrible days there. He convinced his wife to give him and procure from him LSD. He knew that he was terminal and he knew the day he was dying. He just knew it. And he asked her to give that to him. And Huxley literally underwent those same hallucinations and beliefs and visions and things he saw when he did that years ago on the experiments for the books, The Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell. So he died that way. That's how he wanted to go. He didn't want to go looking at the world with regular messed up eyes and pain. He wanted to go with a little bit less pain and a little bit more joy. He died that way. Fascinating enough, Alex Huxley's death was not newsworthy because he died on the very same day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. So I know it's a little unusual, a little kind of spooky. So people didn't even realize until days later that he had died. I mean, I think some newspapers had to reprint it or retalk about it because, you know, the whole JFK thing, is that swamped the news for quite some time. So he died in Arizona. Throat. Tongue cancer. Probably because, you know, he was always a pipe smoker, so it's probably where he got that horrible stuff from. He wasn't a smoker, but he was a pipe smoker, and, you know, a lot of those British writers were back then. And he died in that fashion. I'm glad he found some version of peace that he can get for himself, and to die with somebody that he still did care for, and, you know, in a place he wanted to be at. He liked the environment and the weather in Arizona, and that's where he died. All right, folks, until next time, the next classic spotlight will be in the month of May, and that'll be George Orwell, talking about 1984, some of his observations and lessons he learned in the political system of British running India before it became a free country. Be very interesting. Until next time, folks, God bless, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.